This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to the 16th edition of Word for Word. I'd like to thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris and this is the final episode of our 16-week series focusing on LGBTI influencers. Each week we have sat down with those who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today our guest is a high-profile city councillor. This distinguished man is a musician, a teacher, and an experienced community and political campaign consultant. He has been described as the future of art in Melbourne and has been a well-known face supporting creativity from paint to cinema. You probably have even seen him at events right across the city. His passion for the city of Melbourne is electric, and since being elected to council in 2012, he has proven that he even has the chops to one day be mayor. He is an active member of the LGBTI community, and in this by-election, he is running for the Lord Mayor of Melbourne. He promises to balance sustainability, livability, and good design heritage. Such is the life for today's guest. I would like to welcome you and welcome Rowan Leppett.
We need to make sure that new development is sustainable, it's high quality, so that Melbourne in 30 years' time is everything that we love about Melbourne.
He was elected to council in 2012.
Normally, I think a good politician is someone who doesn't want to be a politician.
If you win this by-election and you become the Lord Mayor of Melbourne, what should we expect from you?
At the City of Melbourne, Rohan is chair of approximately 372 committees.
Would be remiss of me to not ask about the disgraced former mayor, Robert Doyle. Were you surprised to hear about those allegations?
Wanted to get involved, just wanted to make sure that if there was something that I could do to help make the world a better place, even at a very local level, that I was doing it. That's quite the intro.
Your story is actually quite interesting because you've been hard at work trying to make a career in politics. How did you get into politics? Like, what was the passion?
Well, one thing really led to another over time. I've always been interested in politics because there's only one planet and we've got to make sure that we're living sustainably, and a lot of decisions that need to be made around how we do live are made at the different government levels. So I've always wanted to influence politics in some way. One thing's led to another, and I eventually found myself elected to Melbourne City Council. And of course, cities have a wonderful opportunity to tackle global issues like climate change.
I think we agree on some of this stuff, so we're going to get into that a little bit later. But I was going to ask you, what do you think and how do you describe what makes a good politician?
That's a good question. This is going to catch me out straight away, but normally I think a good politician is someone who doesn't want to be a politician. That's because people who crave power for its own sake generally tend to be the most dangerous sort of politician. So it's difficult because you're looking for the more humble people. I'm not saying I'm necessarily one of them, in order to have someone who's genuine in that role. And of course, the more ambitious you are, the less likely that is to be the case. So it's always a difficult friction.
Growing up in Canberra, you would have tackled the same set of issues that a lot of gay men would have had around Australia. Can you tell us a little bit about what you were like as a child?
I grew up in Canberra and that's why I live in Melbourne now, right? I moved to Melbourne literally hours after I finished my final bout at year 12. And Canberra, for me, like for many people, was just a small town. It's a very spread out town, as most people will know. And it's really difficult to find your crew in a place like that. That's why I love Melbourne, because, you know, right in the heart of Melbourne, it's a wonderfully vibrant place. It's cosmopolitan, it's dense, you don't have to go far to find someone who gets you, who understands your wavelength. So Canberra to me has always been a big country town rather than the city that it might appear to be on paper. I'm much happier as a person in Melbourne.
I think a lot of people that have come to Melbourne sort of feel the same way. But what sort of personality traits did you have as a kid? What were you like? Away from talking
about
the city.
Who's interested in this? I was a very shy kid. I was a reasonable student, but I mightn't have been the most vivacious sort of person going around. I kept to myself a little bit.
And what was your relationship like with your parents?
Very good with my mother, but spot the gay man. Maybe not quite as solid with my father, but I've tried to make amends there as well. It is a quite close-knit family. All four grandparents are German and came here for the Snowy Mountain Scheme. Both of my parents were born in Australia, but it's very much a German extended family. I'm very lucky to have German citizenship as well. So extended family and nostalgia has always been quite strong in my family. And yeah, it's always been quite close.
What impact did your parents have on you as you were growing up?
Well, a big impact, like anyone, but they were very, very different parents. They were both Christians, though, so I grew up in a quite a Christian household. And that's actually where my musical training first came from. So that wasn't always comfortable for me, and I'm certainly not a Christian anymore, but all those Christian values were certainly instilled in me from early on.
Mm. So you had a close relationship with your mother, but not such a close relationship with your father. Do you have siblings?
I've got a sister, and she lives in Melbourne. She's even more of a hippie, stereotypical green than I could ever be.
So did you sort of coerce her into moving from Canberra to Melbourne, or did she want to do that anyway?
She's always made her own decisions. She's travelled around the world and she's lived all sorts of places, but she lives in Melbourne at the moment.
From when you were younger to growing up into being an adult, what impact did your sexuality have? What changes did you notice about yourself from being a child to being an adult? Do you think that your sexuality threw you off course at all?
Look, probably. I wasn't out when I lived in Canberra. I wasn't out at school. It was an environment that I felt very, very uncomfortable in. At the time, I don't think that I felt uncomfortable because I knew I was not heterosexual or anything like that. But certainly when I moved to Melbourne and I could experience a whole lot of new things, when I could live independently and move around independently, that I realised there were entire communities in Melbourne who shared the same feelings, the same thoughts, the same politics as me. And so moving to Melbourne and my sexuality and the development of that sort of happened at the same time.
Does your family think of your sexuality now? Like, what does your sister think of it? Did she ever have any problems with you being a gay man?
No, she's always been wonderful, as has my mother. My father took a little bit longer, but he's got there as well. Yeah, my family's pretty good.
You know, it's interesting. With my mum, I think when I told her, she struggled with it in her own way. But then as time has gone on, it's almost like she's very interested in the culture of it. Do you have, like, open conversations with your mum about your sexuality?
Generally, yeah. So she knows about partners past and she is there to listen to me when I've got an issue about any sort of relationship that's going on, and she's quite wonderful about that. And she was in Melbourne 2 weekends ago to see Priscilla, so she's a pretty cool mum.
What did you think of Priscilla?
She loved it.
Okay. There's probably been dark sides throughout your life as you come to terms with your sexuality, but if you're looking back, do you feel proud of where you are now?
I feel happier where I am now. I haven't always been the most secure person in my own skin, especially in Canberra and maybe the early years of when I lived in Melbourne. But in the last 10 years, I've done quite a lot of very, very different things, which I've had a great fortune to do, and I'm much happier now than I have been.
I mean, we all have to get to these places eventually. It's so funny though, when you think about your sexuality and growing up, like, how old were you when you had your first relationship?
19, I think.
How long was that relationship?
Not long.
It's like when you think about all those...
My first long relationship for 4 years was... I must have been 20, I think.
And how long was that relationship?
Four years.
And what happened to him?
Which is a long time in gay years.
You know, your story wakes people up in lots of ways, and lots of people follow you because of your ability now to sort of follow your dreams. Is it strange to think of where you've gotten to? Like, is it strange to realise that you're as prolific as you are?
I think prolific is probably exaggerating things a little bit. I'm still a local councillor at the end of the day, but I do get to do all sorts of wonderful things at the moment. In my portfolio at council, I do get to deal with the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, Midsummer, a variety of other organisations with a strong queer angle to them, and all of that comes within my portfolio. So if I thought 10 years ago that I'd have the privilege to do all of this, well, I wouldn't have thought that at all. So I do feel very fortunate.
You know, from adolescence to your political success, you found your feet with your passion of music and arts. So as you're growing up, can you talk to me a little bit about your passion for the arts?
Yes, I've always loved music from a very early age. My parents made sure that I was studying some sort of musical instrument, and after a very short dalliance with the recorder, I went straight to the piano. Later on, and this is the nerdiest thing you're going to hear today, I learned the pipe organ through churches, had a very religious upbringing. That does seem like a very long time ago. But I always loved music, and I love group music as well, which is hard sometimes when you're on the piano, but I always loved accompanying the school choir, and I always loved accompanying chapel at school, and all that sort of stuff really gave me the thrill. So that was my upbringing. I moved to Melbourne to study music, and while that wasn't as enjoyable, yeah, music's always been a massive part of my life.
And then sort of moving from your passion of music, then you moved into wanting to go into politics. What was your first step into politics?
Well, I never got involved in student politics because I took one look at it and realised that it was a bit terrifying. Like many people, I think, looking at the lack of opposition from the Labor Party to some of these really important international issues, particularly around refugee movements and climate change, is what spurred me on. 2001, of course, was the Tampa year, and that's something that influenced me greatly. I would have joined the Greens a year or two after that, I think, yeah.
And so your first job, well, I guess your first paid job, what would that have been?
My first paid job in Melbourne was Lady Shoes at Myer. It was great. Now, let's talk about that. I miss that job. It's a great job. I was the king of Lady Shoes at Bourke Street Myer. Oh, it was great. I miss that job. No, it's really good. That was part of my the development of my sexuality as well. It was fantastic. Sorry, where were we?
We're talking about politics.
Politics, so my first paid job.
So your first break into politics, what would you say that is?
Well, I joined at the 2002 and just wanted to get involved, just wanted to make sure that if there was something that I could do to help make the world a better place, even at a very local level, that I was doing it. So volunteering in a political party can often take you in all sorts of different directions. I developed a whole lot of skills over the years in campaigning, in party administration, even the really boring jobs, you know, making sure that the party's finances tick over. Eventually, I became an assistant campaign manager for Adam Bandt in 2007. Mm-hmm. And then the first paid job, as you said, was Adam Bandt's campaign in 2010, which was the year that he won and broke into the House of Representatives. It's the first time the Greens have ever won a seat at a general election in the House of Reps.
Pretty impressive.
So that was a massive time for the Greens and a huge learning curve for me. The day after the election, Adam was, you know, contacted by Tony Abbott and Julia Gillard, and both were furiously arguing to him that they've got the best environmental credentials. It was all quite funny. And yeah, the next two years after that, I had the great privilege of being Adam's legislative advisor in the House of Reps, and that meant I got to talk to Bob Katter every day. It's great fun.
What's the big lesson learned from that relationship?
From the Bob Katter relationship?
Yeah.
Look, it's odd. He's a nice man, right? His politics are disgusting, but he's a nice man. When I broke my arm when I was working for Adam in Parliament House, he sent me a card and it said, "Ha ha, now you can't hit me," or something like that. It was just baffling, but he's actually a very generous and kind man, so long as we weren't talking about, you know, LGBTI issues, I suppose.
Well, that's the thing, is there's that very strange quote of him talking about the LGBTI community and then quickly talking about crocodiles eating people.
Yes, and the sudden change of mood from jovial to angry. Yes, I've watched that a few times.
I mean, you know, people are entitled to their sexual proclivities, you know. I mean, let there be a thousand blossoms bloom, as far as I'm concerned, you know. But I ain't spending any time on it, because in the meantime, every 3 months, a person is torn to pieces by a crocodile in North Queensland.
So was that what he was like to work with? Could you find, like, really big mood swings with him?
No.
He was always really nice.
Look, like all politicians, there's everyone has a different approach to how they appear publicly, and no one's their true selves in front of a camera or anything like that. So my only experience with Bob Katter was behind the scenes in his office when he's in a good mood. He was always a very kind man. I know that's strange to hear, but, you know.
Well, I think it's really funny that you talk about that, because a lot of politicians do have two different personalities. There's who they really are, and then there's what's been affected by, I think, their ambition and what they're trying to put out there. But you don't strike me like, you don't seem to have that at all. Would you say that you have a duality like other politicians, or would you say that you are consistent?
Well, it's probably for other people to judge, right? It's very difficult to say what your personality is yourself. I'm naturally a pretty shy person, and it's always been a bit outside my comfort zone to have a particular presentation in public. I've had to learn to be a public speaker. I've had to learn to argue my case in public. But, yeah, that comes in time. The reason I ran for council in the first place wasn't to promote myself, wasn't to be known. It was to change policy at a local level, and that's the part of the job I've always loved the most.
Well, you're being very successful in all of what you've done so far. So from 2010, from doing that, to 2012, being elected yourself, what happened in that time zone?
That's right. So before that, I was working for Adam Bandt in Parliament.
Yep.
Still teaching as well in Melbourne. So I've always loved teaching kids music and still do a little bit of that at the moment. But then in 2012, the opportunity came up to run for council with my wonderful friend and colleague, Cathy Oak, who's the other Green on council. And I did. And fortunately, I scraped through and won.
Was that a surprise to you?
I'm going to be cocky and say no, because we had mapped out the campaign very carefully. We'd had a few cracks at it already, and we did increase our vote, and it was a good election. So it all felt pretty good during the election.
It all kind of worked out for you.
Yes.
Did you get any media training at all? Like, or was that just learnt from other people?
Why do you ask? Because the interview is going so well.
No, I just think it's so interesting because, I mean, from your perspective, you have particular opinions about your politics, but then that doesn't necessarily mean that people have an ability to talk to the media. Did you try and get any training to do that?
So early in the term, there's various training offered to councillors. Media would have been among it, but it takes quite a while to learn the ropes at Town Hall. City of Melbourne has so many different services and projects on the go at any one time, and understanding the legislative context that they sit within and the history of all of those projects really takes a long time. So yes, there was training, but that's no equivalent to learning on the job, and that's really what a councillor is. Every day you learn something new and you've just got to rise to that challenge.
Who are your heroes? Like, who's helped you along the way?
So my Greens colleague, Cathy Oak, we work together so brilliantly well. We get to share an office, and she's just completely wonderful. But we do work together well as a council as well. And even though our previous Lord Mayor, Robert Doyle, has left under circumstances that we're all aware of now, even he was quite a great mentor to many of us in many ways. And the council officers, I mean, there's no shortage of support and help in an organisation as strong and robust as the City of Melbourne.
How much have you changed? Like, you know, with your experiences thus far, have you noticed any big changes in the way you think about things politically?
Well, I suppose one of the things I've learnt in politics since being elected is that effecting change is much more complicated than it appears on the outside. And having a very clear position and a very clear voting position and a soundbite that cuts through and is understood by your constituents, by the community at large, might not necessarily be the most effective thing you can do as a decision maker, especially on councils, when getting anything through isn't a matter of a voting majority necessarily. It's about working with your colleagues. It's about working with officers, trying to find out who agrees with what. But a lot of that happens behind the scenes as well. And it's not as straightforward as a parliamentary vote, for example. So the public doesn't see a huge amount of that, and I wish that they could see more of it, but there's only so much that the public wants to know about local councils at the end of the day, of course. But yeah, I've learnt that decision making in local government is a lot more complicated than it might appear.
Than what it looks like.
Yeah.
Don't try this at home, is essentially what you're saying.
Maybe, yeah. I'm not sure about policies that have necessarily changed. I've learnt a lot more about what makes a livable city, and everything that we treasure in Melbourne about the vibrancy of the inner city does come from decades of very carefully crafted decisions by government. And making sure that we keep that in the future is something that we need really, really well-trained and knowledgeable councillors to know about. These things aren't automatic.
When I was looking at all of, you know, the backstory to you, some people had described you as being quite outspoken with some of the development issues, you know, the Federation Square, with putting an Apple store in there. You know, why do you think people described you as being outspoken during that time?
Well, someone's got to be. It's one thing to have a wonderful consensus-based council, which it really was under Robert Doyle for the most part. But sometimes you've got to call out these shocking decisions. And when the state government does things like approve a new Apple store at Federation Square without even so much as telling the public that they're going to do it, or a new tower for Crown on the banks of South Bank that breaks every planning rule in the book and needs its own very special planning rules to facilitate it. Someone's got to call that stuff out, and it's not the opposition in Parliament, and it hasn't been the City of Melbourne at many times, and so, you know, I do it when I can. Someone's got to.
Why does something like a second tower at Crown get pushed forward so quickly, do you think?
Well, you can speculate about whether or not the on-the-record donations from Crown to the government of the day has anything to do with it. But look, Crown's got massive influence in this city, and I think people know that, and I think people know that large developers do get to have meetings with planning ministers, and that's not the case for smaller developers or community interest groups necessarily. And so there is this general concern that governments, whether that's the council or whether that's the state government, isn't always developing Melbourne in the public interest. And sometimes development is giving too much weight to those that sit to gain a profit rather than where we actually want Melbourne to be in 30 years' time and what we want the streets to look and feel like.
What's the driving force behind the protection of Melbourne landmarks? Like, for you personally, why is that something that is you're so passionate about?
I'm passionate about Melbourne's heritage because it tells us who we are and where we've come from as a city. Heritage is one of the most wonderful ways that you can educate people about our history as well. So heritage protection in Melbourne is a little bit undercooked at the moment. There are too many buildings, too many objects, and too many stories that are under-recognised. And above and beyond protecting heritage for its own sake, I think the more you document and value what is valued by the community at large and require developers to take that into account and to engage architects who are going to design a building that keeps heritage as part of that new design, it just makes the city so much more interesting. The last thing we want is to convert our city into these massive, massive blocks that don't have that fine-grained human scale, slightly messy feel at the ground floor and just has a one-size-fits-all tower in the sky that doesn't really talk to Melbourne's heritage. And what we really want is to keep doing what we know that we do really, really well and have those smaller blocks with the laneways and the fine-grain public realm.
But where does that passion personally come from for you?
Well, again, maybe it's because I grew up in Canberra, which is the exact opposite, and it's a planning disaster as far as I'm concerned. Sorry, Walter Burley Griffin. Look, you can't find the middle of Canberra, can you? It's all just roundabouts and front yards. It's a funny place. I never really enjoyed it. But my passion for planning started the day I moved to Melbourne, I think.
While things have been heating up with the by-election, it would be remiss of me to not ask about the disgraced former mayor, Robert Doyle. Were you surprised to hear about those allegations?
Yes and no. I mean, I certainly didn't witness anything along the lines of that which was alleged. But that's kind of the point, isn't it? I mean, we've learnt a lot about how power does operate, and all of these sexual harassment allegations do have everything to do with power. And as a man, these things weren't going to happen in front of me, I don't think. But
if they had happened in front of you, would you have done something about it?
I'd like to think so.
Well, even if you'd heard rumours about this, would you say that you would have followed it up?
Well, that's a difficult question because it depends how reliable a rumour might be. I've heard a lot more rumours after the allegations came out than ever before, that's for sure.
So usually when something comes forward, then a lot more come forward.
That's right.
Harvey Weinstein's a perfect example. Then all of a sudden, you know, a Me Too campaign like this happens and then people jump on it and they come out with their stories. I knew of people that were affected by Harvey Weinstein. I mean, I didn't know anyone that was affected by Robert Doyle, but at the same time, I think moving forward with that sort of thing happening in workplaces and the abuse of power, I do think if you hear something, do you follow it up?
Well, absolutely you should. But this is the other interesting thing about what's happened over the last 3 months. People have been asking, even those who were victims of sexual harassment, why weren't these issues followed up at the time? And that's got everything to do with the power dynamics at play, which aren't defined in the law, aren't defined in the rules of a council. They're found in other ways. And when you're in a position for 9.5 years, perhaps not everyone's realised just how much power and clout has been accrued by one person. I can't talk about specifics here because there's still further investigations underway into Robert's conduct, but it is a very difficult place that the City of Melbourne's in at the moment, and it's a very sad place. I mean, I miss former councillor Tessa Sullivan. She has felt that she needed to resign in order to get justice here, and her place on council is very much missed. And Robert, of course, was a very good mayor in many ways, including a great friend and ally to the LGBTI community. And it's a pity that this is what's happened and so few of us were actually aware of it. And this is the end of a otherwise distinguished career.
If you were to become the mayor of Melbourne, the Lord Mayor of Melbourne, what would you put in place to make sure that these sorts of things didn't happen again? I mean, looking at sexual harassment, like what can you put in place to make sure people in the workplace working with you, not to say that you would do anything, but what would you put in place to make sure that didn't happen?
Well, a few things need to be done, and I don't think there's any one silver bullet. The code of conduct for councillors obviously needs to be much more accessible. It needs to be really clear to anyone who wants to make a complaint that there's a process for them to do that, and it's going to involve people who are impartial. We didn't have that at the City of Melbourne, and that was one of the problems. We also need to make sure that there's a perception and a reality that the Lord Mayor's office is open, transparent and accountable. So I think an open door policy and making sure a few of those obvious things like, you know, an alcohol-free Lord Mayor's office is good practice. And I think that and even if the incumbent wouldn't be someone who is inclined to do that, I think the perception of a clean, open office is just as important.
It's so funny though, because I mean, you wonder whether or not people feel like they can get away with that sort of behavior because it's happened over time. It's like, how does someone like Robert Doyle think that he can get away with something like that? That's what I think.
But it's an alcohol thing, right?
Yeah,
he doesn't know.
Yeah, right.
But the most important thing is that very clearly defined in the Local Government Act, sexual harassment constitutes misconduct. So at the moment, that's not the case, and it's difficult to know what sort of misconduct sexual harassment might be, and therefore it's difficult to know for a councillor how to initiate proceedings against another councillor. So it's really important that the new Local Government Act makes reference to sexual harassment.
If you win this by-election and you become the Lord Mayor of Melbourne, what should we expect from you?
Show tunes blaring out of the public safety system on every street corner.
No. Any particular show tune?
Anything from Company.
Okay.
No. So obviously my passion at the moment is making sure that Melbourne is developed in the public interest. What I mean by that is spending more on high quality and sustainable design now. Yes, that's slightly more expensive, but if we require that of our developers, it means that the long-term savings to the community and to the planet, to be honest, are saved. So at the moment, we've got too much what I'm calling cheap density in the middle of the city, and we need to make sure that new development is sustainable, it's high quality, so that Melbourne in 30 years' time is everything that we love about Melbourne at the moment and not going in the wrong direction.
I guess if you're looking back, what would you like to be going, "That's what I did"?
I just love Melbourne to be known as a vibrant and interesting city. I'm just not sure that, well, I know that the planning system we've got in place at the moment and the policies that are being put in place by both the state government and other levels of government at the moment aren't building the sort of city that makes for vibrant communities, that makes for interest and variety, particularly at the street level. Melbourne is loved because of those excellent decisions that were made, you know, decades ago for the streets to be a particular width, for blocks to be of a particular size and for buildings to be of a particular shape. It's why Melbourne's laneway culture is 100 times better than Sydney's. It's why the middle of Melbourne is so easy to get around, and it's why Melbourne is so vibrant. I mean, the middle of Melbourne really is the most remarkable place, the most remarkable urban place in this country. And I really want to make sure that that's what we've got in 50 years' time as well.
For young LGBTI people out there who might be listening to this right now, and if they're wanting to get into politics, what advice do you have for them?
Do it. We need more LGBTI people in politics. I'm never going to say, vote for me because I'm gay, and I'd always frown upon anyone who thinks that they should be supported just because they might be LGBTI. But you need that diversity in parliaments, in councils, so that you do have a variety of opinions and a variety of life experiences among your decision makers. It just makes for better decisions.
Is there a lack of LGBTI people in government?
I think there's particularly a lack of lesbian and trans people in politics. I think we're getting more and more gay men into politics at the moment, which is a good thing. There's been quite an increase in the number of councillors at the last general election, thanks in part to a lot of really good work by the VLGA, the Victorian Local Governance Association. And of course, there's now quite a few high-profile gay men in federal politics, as well as a couple of lesbians. But there's certainly a lot more room for more of us, I would have thought. I've never really figured out, though, why there's so many gay men in the machine of the Liberal and Labor Party. I mean, young Liberal and young Labor members, there's just so many white gay men out there. I just don't understand why that is.
I think that I've somehow put white gay male politicians in the same box as reality TV people. And I think that they didn't have a lot of friends in high school and they struggled socially. And then I think that in their adult life, they're looking for validation and redemption. And in the process of doing that means that it comes across probably not as organic as what it should be. And it's more about power and less about politics. It's more about them and proving something to themselves that they felt that they were lacking.
The first half, I was worried that it was going to describe me.
Are you looking to be validated?
No, look, the reason I'm running for Lord Mayor is pretty simple. It's a by-election in pretty unusual circumstances with the resignation of Robert Doyle, and there's 2.5 years to go on this term. We need someone who's absolutely committed to a healthy culture and a clean and transparent style of governance at Town Hall. That's best placed by someone who's a sitting councillor. And on top of that, I'm really, really passionate about making sure that council is known for governing in the public interest and making sure that Melbourne is developed in the public interest. That's why I'm running. If there's anything to do with validation about my childhood, I think that would be a mistake, but I don't think there is.
What about those people out there that would say that you're too young to be the mayor? What do you have to say to those people?
I'd say I'm much older than the median age of the City of Melbourne resident, which is 28. And it's about time we had some youth at Town Hall. But I don't think a lack of experience should be the concern, because I have been on council for 6 years and am known as a pretty well-rounded and dedicated councillor. And so, yeah, I don't think that I'm too young, but I'm sure other people will say that.
What about the fact that, you know, you'll be the first Greens member elected?
Well, that's, of course, much more terrifying for people. Not only the first Greens elected in this role, but potentially the first Greens Lord Mayor in the country. It's about making sure we've got someone who can lead and facilitate a team of 11 very gifted and skilled councillors, right? The Lord Mayor doesn't have executive power, and we shouldn't be running an election campaign as though he or she does. So political allegiance is one thing, but generating trust and goodwill amongst a team of 11 is really the only thing that matters.
Mm.
Otherwise, you're not going to be an effective Lord Mayor. So I'm sure people will refuse to vote for me because they couldn't bring themselves to vote for a Green. By the same token, I'm sure people who I've worked very closely with for 6 years who have never thought they ever would vote for a Green would be only too happy to. So it'll be an interesting election.
What is your honest feeling about this election? Like, when you put your hand up for this, you know, what was your honest feeling about what's going to happen?
Well, that was why I hesitate, right? Because there's a very good chance that the Greens could win in this context. And it's this by-election's quite a sudden prospect for everyone. And it is a big change to plans to follow through with it. I think the election's likely to come down to two or three candidates, including myself. We've got the very able Sally Capp, who's the CEO of the Property Council, who is being supported quite widely by certain media outlets and many financial backers. And it may be her and I against the world at the final hurdle. We've also got former councillor Ken Ong running as well, who is reasonably prominent. So these elections are always unpredictable. Preferences are always going to play a big role. And the lower turnout, because by-elections tend to have lower turnouts, could throw in a few interesting opportunities to the mix as well.
We need to get Jackie Gillies in from The Real Housewives. She's apparently a psychic. She'd be able to predict whether or not it's going to happen.
I don't know that I believe that she really is. I know that's sacrilegious to say.
Well, not necessarily. I'm sure that there's a lot of people out there that are questioning Jackie Gillies' ability to be a psychic. Have you watched all of The Real Housewives of Melbourne?
Yes, every episode.
Who's your favourite?
Janet, easy.
We have that in common. That's so funny. Let's just see.
That's my first policy. If Lord Mayor, I'll give the keys of the city to every real housewife in Melbourne.
That's a terrifying thought.
They do a lot for our community.
Well, I'm just going to say that Melbourne looks fantastic on the show.
Yes, that's true.
There's lots of moments where I'm like, wow, you know.
I reckon our reputation's tarnished in other ways, but yes, Melbourne looks very pretty.
We as a community, we've been on a real journey with our place in society. What do you think of the current landscape of the LGBTI community? What would you say are some of the things that we face now moving forward?
That's a really big question, and in many ways, and I'm going to try my hardest not to sound like I'm not a 100% supporter of equal marriage, because of course I absolutely was and have moved many motions at council along these lines. But over the last few years, all LGBTI issues have really been seen by society at large through this prism of equal rights for couples and the equal marriage debate. And it means that our community has been dominated by gay and lesbian leaders, which is fine. But in many ways, there needs to be a much stronger focus on trans and intersex issues, and not just issues surrounding couples. So there's a lack of understanding in the LGBTI community, just as there is in society at large, around trans issues and what to do to make sure that discrimination against trans people is eradicated, even in our own community.
It's interesting that you talk about this, about the visibility for trans people. What do we need to do to make sure there's more visibility for the trans community?
We'll just make sure that trans people are part of decision-making for issues that affect them. One of the most remarkable things I think the City of Melbourne did this year was the Coming Back Out Ball, which predominantly was for ageing gay and lesbian people, but certainly trans people as well. I think the dignity that society needs to extend to trans people just isn't there at the moment, especially older trans people who might not have the support networks that they need and just don't know where to get them. So trans visibility is about, you know, putting trans people into decision-making fora and everything that the city does. I mean, there's so many opportunities to include people from a variety of backgrounds.
So does that mean that, like, let's say you become the Lord Mayor, would you be looking to put a trans person on your staff?
If only I had directly appoint staff. That's still a decision for the CEO. But, yeah, I think the City of Melbourne has some good targets, particularly for Indigenous employment, and that should be extended more to people from diverse gender and sexual orientation backgrounds.
Well, how much responsibility do you feel like you have for the LGBTI community as a person?
Well, as soon as I say I have any, I'll have people disputing that, right? So it's a difficult question. I mean, as a gay man, I'm involved in the LGBTI community, whether I like it or not. But of course I do like it. I think it's wonderful being gay, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Through my job, though, I get to peer into and support all of our premier queer organisations, including occasionally Joy, but especially Midsummer and the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. And we all have a lot to learn in life, and I've certainly learned a lot over the last 6 years through those organisations as well. The City of Melbourne has a really important role to support LGBTI people through organisations like that, and I think there is more that we could be doing.
Do you think your sexuality affects the way that people think, what people think of you?
Look, it probably does, but and even if I say it shouldn't, I think it does. Most interestingly, I think that comes into play most sharply when there are queer issues on the agenda of a council meeting, and suddenly gay men in particular will expect me to vote a certain way or represent them in a certain way. So whilst we're all super keen to say that sexuality shouldn't matter, it often matters most when gay men would like me to do something in particular. So what I'm thinking of there is the sister city relationship with St. Petersburg, which is one of the most challenging things that I've had to deal with on council. We do have a sister city relationship, of course, and there were really, really strong calls from the LGBTI community in particular to suspend or end that sister city relationship. And in the end, I decided for myself that I couldn't support that for a few reasons. The main one was that there were these wonderful exchanges between schools in St. Petersburg and schools in Melbourne, which allowed, you know, Russian students to come over here and experience something different. One of the excursions, if you like, went back via the Sydney Mardi Gras, and I thought that's wonderful. I don't think I'd like to end those, and that's what would have happened if we stopped the sister-city relationship. But the main reason is that activists on the ground in St. Petersburg said, don't do it. Use those networks to keep communicating with the government in St. Petersburg, raising these concerns, keeping the pressure on. And I'm not suggesting for a second that we can change the world from town hall at Melbourne, but the very fact that activists are saying, use that position for good, don't just throw your hands in the air and leave us isolated. Well, I think we should be listening to those voices much more strongly than people in Melbourne saying for their own reasons that we should suspend the sister-city relationship. I think it's more important to listen to those in St. Petersburg. But people were really split on that, and I've certainly received my fair share of hate mail after that one.
Why do you think that gay men had such a problem or were so passionate about deceasing that relationship?
I don't know why it was gay men in particular, but it all comes down to your theory of change. Are you severing the relationship to be seen to be taking a strong stand and therefore making your local constituents happy that the government is taking a stand in that way? Or do you want to keep using that influence, problematic though that might be? So I don't know why it was gay men in particular who were saying we must suspend the relationship, but it was. And yeah, it's always been something that's puzzled me a little bit. I was getting the most angry letters from gay men.
And it's because you believe you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, it's because I don't think politics is as simple as that, and I don't believe in an isolationist policy. I mean, the City of Melbourne isn't an international player. We don't have a foreign affairs department, right? But we have this opportunity to raise with the government of St. Petersburg whenever we want, and we do, our concerns with the way that Russian citizens are being treated, and we should use that.
We should keep those lines of communication open and influence.
Yeah. And more than that, we should allow these exchanges between the cities to keep occurring.
With the introduction of PrEP as a medication, it's funny, I noticed that you tweeted about this. You know, obviously you're in support of PrEP, and it's now available Australia-wide, and so it should be. But the question I have for you is, when do you think we should be educating young people on PrEP? Do you think that there's an age that we should start influencing people?
See, if I nominate an age, I'll be taken out of context, and this will be the rest of my campaign responding to it. I don't know. I'm not an educator or an education policymaker.
But you are supportive of PrEP.
Absolutely. I think it's part of the way that we as a community need to tackle HIV. It's not the be-all and end-all. But the thing that PrEP has done so wonderfully over the last couple of years, really, is improve the way that men in particular communicate about sex. And safe sex isn't just about a device or a pill. It's about open conversation.
And then when should that conversation be happening for young people, though?
I don't know. I mean,
how old were you when you worked out your sexuality?
I don't think I identified as gay until it was simplistic to do so when I was elected to public office. But certainly I was out and queer, if you like, from pretty much the moment I arrived in Melbourne.
So like 18?
Yeah.
Do you think 18 is the age appropriate for you that you should be talking about PrEP?
Look, probably. You know, it's important to have discussions around safe sex and what it means to have an open and honest discussion with a sexual partner from an early age.
But obviously, parents are going to come out and be like, that's too young to be educating my kids on this sort of stuff. You know, my kid isn't gay, but then you don't necessarily know. So when can you start having a conversation that's going to be implemented to young people that there's a product out there that could prevent you from having HIV?
And it's important to have that known. And we can't always expect parents to know how to have those discussions with kids, especially if parents, as they usually are heterosexual and their kids aren't. So it's about public services being as in your face as they can be to make sure that people know where to go for this sort of information. So the City of Melbourne was a fast-track city for HIV reduction, nominated a couple of years ago when we had the AIDS conference here in Melbourne. And I think there's a role for government. Mostly, obviously, it's a state government issue. And again, I'm no educator and I don't know about when it's the right age to have these sorts of discussions. But having that information readily available through a variety of media is important, and it will keep the community healthier because it means more people will know how to access the information.
You know what's also interesting at the moment is there seems to be a real divide of cultures, with a lot of gay people wanting to still embrace the queer culture and be known for their gay culture. And then there's also a lot of people wanting to sort of, for lack of a better word, normalize and just be treated like everybody else. You know, how do you look at those two forks in the road?
And again, the equal marriage debate really took us down a particular direction, where one way to look at that is that it's something very conservative that we're asking for. We're asking for entry into a very, very conservative institution. And it's actually shouldn't be surprising that that campaign's been led by a lot of conservative white gay men. I'm thinking of the Tim Wilsons of the world, that this campaign has been embraced so much by conservatives across the country. Yes, of course, the backlash against the equal marriage debate came largely from conservatives as well, but my point is that this shouldn't always be seen as the progressive campaign that we often assume it is. The thing I love about Mardi Gras, the thing I love about Pride March, is that we still protest and that we still celebrate difference. And yes, we want equality in the law in all things, but that should not be the same as trying to be like the rest of society, trying to be like heterosexual couples. I mean, what fun would there be in being gay if we had to be like heterosexual couples? I can't think of anything worse.
Well, at the same time, it's so funny though, because like some of the queer community, you know, want to get married and have heteronormative relationships, you know, it's interesting. And then there's others that are wanting to push away from that at the same time.
Yeah, I saw an SBS study come out a couple of days ago saying that younger gay people are now more likely to be leading monogamous relationships than older gay couples or couples their age, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, they're looking for the white picket fence, or, you know, they're looking to have basically heteronormative relationships like, you know, their forefathers, you know. So it's interesting to see that younger people are wanting to blend into society.
Well, good on them if that's what they want. It's not for me or for a putative Lord Mayor or potential Lord Mayor to moralise about what a good relationship is and isn't, but each to their own.
You know, why do you think young people are wanting to have the normal relationship, to get married, to have the white picket fence?
That's what society has valued. I mean, one of the interesting things about Julia Gillard's answer on this was that it was in many ways much more radical than the position that the LGBTI community were asking her to take. It was consistent with the second wave feminist idea that really what we should be looking for is the abolition of marriage, so that the state didn't even have a role to play in sanctioning relationships of any kind.
Mm.
Now, the radical in me thinks that yes, absolutely, that's what we should be striving to, but that's not realistic, and marriage is one in this case, right? LGBTI issues and gay and lesbian people in particular are now so welcome within society compared to where they have been. Obviously, there are massive exceptions to that. That society is embracing those people within the institutions that have been here for so long, such as marriage. With that comes changes to gay and lesbian relationships, and that's inevitable.
So almost like there was a tipping point at some part of looking for marriage equality where we stopped being sort of out there with our sexuality and then we started talking about equality. Do you think that's what got us across the line, was by talking about it more in heteronormative terms?
Possibly, and it's possibly why some of us have felt so uncomfortable being part of the LGBTI community during that debate, because it's about asking for acceptance. It's not about liberation from those structures and those conventions that we've been fighting against that some people have been fighting against for so long.
Do you think we'll see a change in more people being comfortable with coming out of their sexuality in the media?
I'm sure, and that can only be a good thing, especially for young people who need reinforcement and need to know that you know, there's a place for them in the world and that they're not unusual in any way. So yes, it will keep happening, and yes, it's a good thing.
I wonder if the next gay footballer that comes out is just going to be this big spokesperson. They're going to come out and it's going to be too much pressure for them. You know, but someone's going to have to do it. And then in years to come, it should be just normal. Who cares that that person sleeps with a man at the end of the day or for
female? I don't know that we're there yet, but obviously that would be the goal, I think. We are so lucky living in the middle of Melbourne. And as far as the Australian context goes, I think we couldn't, LGBTI people, ask to live in a better place. But beyond those L and G labels, it is still highly problematic for many people, even in a big city like Melbourne. And of course, outside Melbourne, it can be very, very difficult to grow up in a country town or in the country, or even for me in a large country town like Canberra. It's important that people can still see role models in life and understand that they're every bit as normal as everyone else.
It's funny though, like as marriage equality happened, you know, people were like, oh, that's the answer to to a lot of questions. But there still is a lot of homophobic behaviour happening in Australia, you know, because like I remember hearing this story, it was really quite interesting, was that about 2 weeks after marriage equality had happened and yes, there was a big party for it and a lot of people thought things had changed a certain way. And two young boys went out in Sydney and they were attacked. And they were like, oh God, how does this happen to me? Because I thought we were being celebrated.
Well, there is plenty of that at the moment. And you only have to look at the way that people are treating different racial groups and different religious groups as well to understand that we've got a hell of a long way to go. The most important way to improve that, I think, is to do the opposite of what the Peter Duttons of the world are doing, and from those positions of quite considerable power and influence, say the right thing. Make sure that we are emphasising that our communities can and should be welcoming places that value people from all sorts of different backgrounds and treat people equally. Don't try and divide them, much as we're seeing from too much of the government at the moment at the federal level. And those positions of power are really, really important. I mean, culture often comes from the top, and there's a really important role for our politicians beyond, you know, voting in parliament or writing bills or just legislating at their purest sense to lead on these issues and articulate the sort of society that does welcome people. And we don't have anywhere near as much of that as we should.
If you had the chance of being able to meet yourself as a 12-year-old, knowing what you know now, what would you tell yourself?
Maybe that the pipe organ isn't quite as cool a musical instrument to learn as you thought it was. I don't know. I mean, just relax a little bit. I mean, I was a very highly strung kid, just not feeling like I had a place in the world. It's such a cliche with anyone and everyone, you know, joining in on the it gets better idea, but it does. And it's really hard to figure out a way to tell a 12-year-old kid or anyone who's struggling that it does. But we all need to find a way to make sure that kids in schools, kids growing up, don't feel ostracised.
Not to sweat the small stuff as well.
Yeah.
What's something, though, that you've probably overthought and now you think back to and think, why was I thinking that? Like, when I think about myself as a child, I'm always like, when I was a kid, I used to think if I did something, like if I slept with a man or I followed my urges, everyone would know, you know? And so I was so scared about my sexuality because I was terrified that people would know, something would change within me that then would become visible. When in actual fact, I could have just been a deviant and gone off and done it behind people's back. No one would have known. But I didn't do that because I just felt like, oh no, people would know.
Yeah, I always wish that I wasn't so hung up about the way people thought about me and that I'd embraced everything that is exciting and wonderful about being gay a lot earlier. It's tricky though for me to say that at the moment because I've always got nagging on my mind an idea about should I be saying any of this sort of stuff while I'm also running for Lord Mayor of Melbourne.
But it makes you a real person. Like, at the same time, who cares whether you're running for mayor or whether you're the CEO of Coles?
Well, that's the way it should work, of course. But politics doesn't always work that way either. So, you know, inevitably I have had to lead my public life slightly different to the way I lead my private life. And I've kind of enjoyed the semi-anonymity that being a councillor gives you as opposed to a different elected position.
What are your biggest fears that people are going to find out about you?
Well, I'm not going to tell you that either, am I? It's not about what they're going to find out. I think it's more about the perceptions of what it means to have a gay man in charge, right? I think the more that that's discussed, the more that some voters, some more conservative voters, might think that the point is missed. And again, I'm not asking anyone to vote for me because I'm gay. Maybe I'm asking your listeners, maybe, I don't know. I'm running, you know, because of my ideas for the city and making Melbourne a sustainable and livable place.
Have you got a message for the queer community that is listening to this right now?
change the world, run for public office.
Because that's what you did?
Yes, I didn't do it because I'm queer, but absolutely. Our world is a richer place and our decision-making bodies are can only be making better decisions if we have people from all sorts of different backgrounds, and absolutely that includes LGBTI people.
Stand up and have your opinions and make sure they've been heard.
Absolutely.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for coming in here today and being able to share your story. I'd like to thank you for joining Word for Word.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.